For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zengate, and I'm very happy to have as our guest speaker tonight Brook Zipporin. There's several of us here who have been wanting Brook to come speak here for quite a while. So Brook teaches at the University of Chicago Divinity School, right? And is one of the, I would say, one of the foremost American scholars of Chinese Buddhism, and especially of Tiantai Buddhism, which he will talk about tonight, and which is actually very important to our practice here. So just by way of brief introduction, Tiantai is one of the major schools, maybe the first really Chinese school of Chinese Buddhism, and founded by the great teacher and thinker Zhiyi, who lived in the 6th century. And Tiantai, which Brook will talk more about, came to Japan as Tendai Buddhism, and Dogen, the founder of our tradition in Japan, was originally a Tendai monk, and Dogen's teachings are very much in some ways a product of Tiantai Buddhism. So Brook will talk more about that. I wanted to say a little bit more about Brook Zipporin. He's written numbers of books. For example, Beyond Oneness and Difference, and we chant the Chitto's Harmony of Oneness, Sameness, and Difference. Beyond Oneness and Difference, Li and Coherence in Chinese Buddhist Thought and Its Antecedents. One of his forthcoming books is tentatively entitled Against Being Here Now. And I'm glad he's doing that, otherwise I'd have to write that. Another one of his books is Being in Ambiguity. So in addition to philosophical experiments with Tiantai Buddhism, in addition to being one of the greatest American Chinese Buddhist scholars, especially Tiantai, Brook is an extremely creative thinker. And I wanted to just read, just to put him on the spot, I wanted to read a little bit of the opening of Being in Ambiguity. This work contains the answers to all philosophical problems which have hitherto existed and which ever shall exist. All other books are included in and superseded by this book, which finally reveals the absolute truth about the universe and its application to all possible facets of human experience. The crucial paradigm shift has been discovered, which reduces to irrelevance all the bitter struggles of past and present philosophers and theorists in all fields. This discovery has been made by me and explicated in the work you are now holding. Whatever conversations you have hitherto been having with yourself and your alter selves are picked up here, tweaked into a slightly better vocabulary, integrated with all other conversations so that it is revealed that all were about each other and resolved into a far richer set of possibilities and vistas of new experience than you had dared hope for. So I do recommend this book. It's quite dense reading, but nourishing. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much. Dan, did put me on the spot, but worthy introduction. That needs only be read aloud to reveal its ridiculousness. I'm glad to see that. Well, what I wanted to talk about today, really what I want to do today, is sort of read along with you this passage, which is translated from a work called the Mohenjo-gwan, in Japanese, Makashikan, which is by Juri, the founder of the Tiantai tradition in China, actually from a series of lectures given in the year 594, CE, I believe. And I'm sort of, rather than exactly lecturing about it, what I really want to do is sort of read through this line by line and kind of riff on it, try to disentangle it, give you some thoughts as we go through what sense I'm able to make of it, largely because I'm very interested in how this will hit you guys engaged in practice, which actually, I think it is true, traces its ancestry partially to some of the things going on in this text. Let me say a few words about this. This Mohenjo-gwan literally means the great calming and contemplation, but those are the Chinese translations of Samatha and Vipassana, the great Samatha Vipassana, which some of you probably know are the two of the main categories of Buddhist meditation that were coming into China from India. Samatha being focusing the mind, fixing the mind on a meditation object, sometimes a formal meditation object like a disc or on one's breath. And Vipassana, insight meditation, which it's probably its earliest form, involves the application of certain Buddhist categories or ideas or points of view to the observation of a sort of attentiveness to something about phenomenal experience, usually about impermanence, suffering, non-self, observing those in real time, and so on. And these were arranged in various ways in classical Indian Buddhist systems. The Mohenjo-gwan, and indeed this work is in English translation, there is one now by Paul Swanson, which you may know, about 1,500 pages long. It's an immense architectonic work, attempting to sort of integrate all forms of Buddhist meditation under this rubric. Juri, the founder of Tiantai, develops kind of complicated threefold system, but I don't want to go... We can talk about that if you're interested in how that works. I want to just tell you the place of this particular text before we read it, this particular section. So one of the things Juri does at the beginning of this text, he sort of gives... three programs of meditation, which mean three kind of ritual settings, which involve a specific physical practice, ritual procedure, even a time period. Four of those, one he calls the constantly sitting samadhi, which is this one. And then there's a half sitting, half standing, or half walking samadhi. There's a constantly standing samadhi, which involves visualization of Buddhas. And then there's something called neither sitting nor standing samadhi, which, a little tip, when you see that negation a lot of times in Chinese texts, it doesn't mean it excludes sitting and standing. It means neither exclusively sitting nor exclusively standing. So in that case, the last of those is this meditation that's to be done at all times and places, a contemplation of the arising of thought, something that sometimes is linked to later sort of dynamic meditations that concentrate on the activity of the mind rather than the stillness of the mind. So there's not actually a sitting, necessarily formal practice for that fourth one. So these four programs sort of run the gamut from the constantly sitting samadhi, which is this one, to one that is engaged, doesn't involve any formal meditation practice at all. Some scholars have attempted to trace sort of some of the divisions within Chan or Zen to both of them, to these alternate practices within Tiantai. So we have a very formal, constantly sitting samadhi here, and we have an active samadhi that dispenses with the forms of meditation. In Tiantai, both of those are kosher, but they're given as upayas that can, or skillful means that can apply in different times. We can talk more about there's two other sets of categories that go into the Mohenjo-gwan, but those are the ones that matter for this text for today, I think. Now, this constantly sitting samadhi is a very ritualized practice initially. I translated for you in the handouts the last part of it, but actually the part is actually in the Chinese, which I also put in just for the hell of it. Jiri gives, there's two things to know about this. One, as the title of the talk says, the one practice samadhi. Now, this is a term that comes from the Prajnaparamita literature. It's very important in the early history of Chan, of Zen, actually. In Dunhuang materials, we know this is something that was attributed to Dao Xin, the fourth patriarch of Chan, as his specific practice, which derived from a practice very close to this. It involved, I think Thomas Cleary has translated that in the Masters of the Lanka, or Zen Dawn, it's in that book, in English, in Zen Dawn.
Actually, his brother, but anyway.
Oh, is it J.C. Cleary? Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. So, anyway, in that text, he uses exactly the same text Jiri is working with here, which involves first the contemplation of a physical Buddha, and then a sort of dissolving into formlessness of that Buddha as the one practice, and the contemplation of the Buddha mind. This connects to other motifs about Buddha nature, which doesn't come from that sutra tradition. And the same kind of amalgamatory thing is going on here. But that term is also picked up by Hueno, or Eno, in the Platform Sutra, the sixth patriarch, this term, the one practice samadhi. In fact, maybe that comes from Jiri Dao-chan, might be part of his description of the one practice samadhi, right? The direct and straightforward mind. But here's our earliest attempt within the Chinese tradition to give a sort of elaboration on this. And so one practice first meant, among these four physical forms, constantly sitting, only sitting. In the part I didn't translate, Jiri gives you, he's using the standard paradigm of the three types of karma, right? The bodily karma, verbal karma, and mental karma, okay? And so he gives you a bodily thing that's to be done for this practice, a verbal thing, and then a mental thing. I translated the mental thing, what the mind is supposed to be doing, but just FYI, the bodily thing, he says, is a 90-day practice where one is to be constantly sitting, like we were just doing, 30 minutes, kind of brought me to about my limit. But 90 days where one vows not to let one's back hit the floor, to stay awake, and constantly do the following mental practice. Okay, so there's a kind of a very, very rigorous, you might say, scarily ascetic kind of devotional practice involved here. Also, that for the verbal practice there, he says, well, when you get tired, or when you get distracted, or when you get sick, as you probably will doing this for 90 days, you are encouraged to recite the name of a Buddha. Chant the name of a Buddha. Visualize as if you were looking at a Buddha. Choose anyone in one direction. You know, Buddha's in all directions of the cosmos. Visualize him later in the mental part, I'll say, as if looking into a mirror or still water. And chant that name. And he gives a very interesting discussion of that. It's actually rather pragmatic. He says two things. Well, one is very pragmatic, and one is sort of pertains to the phenomenology of religion. The pragmatic one, he says, is, you know, just how when people are depressed in ordinary life, or overexcited, they sing. And the vibration, he literally says, the wind of the vibration has contact with the inner parts of the body, and that sort of smooths out the emotion. Same thing here. Chant the Buddha's name when you can't, when kleshas, you know, disruptions, emotional disruptions or passions or something are disturbing you, or you're tired or you're sick, you do this. The other side, calling down a Buddha to instruct you, sort of set you back to the original practice, which is what he then goes on to describe. So, a physical and a verbal precondition, and then he says, then we get to how the mind is to practice. And it's very interesting. I want to say about, before we launch into this, line by line, I mentioned a moment ago, samatha vipassana. How many of you are familiar with those terms, those Sanskrit terms? Okay, so again, those mean concentration or a stillness or fixing the mind on an object, and then insight or contemplation. And one of the interesting things that we see happening in this text is that Jiri is starting to use these two terms as a, you might, this is a little bit of a cheap move, but I'll do it anyway, a sort of yin-yang picture. as two sides, the stillness and the motion, the negation and the affirmation, the withdrawal and the advance, very much in line with certain things that had been happening in China before Buddhism came into it. He takes them and sort of weaves them together in a much maybe tighter system than they have been used. They, of course, have been used as sort of two wings or two wheels. There is this motif of middle way, of course, very important in Buddhism from the beginning. That gets really accentuated here. So when Jiri wants to talk about even the verbal and the physical, he does it in terms of these pairs. He says the verbal, there's something to say and something to be silent about here in this practice. What do you say? You chant the name of the Buddha. What do you be silent about? All worldly affairs and discussions and so on, right? Physically, one thing to do, affirm, sit, in this case, the one practice samadhi, a lot of things to not do, and these are given to you as a pair. And finally, when he gets mentally into vipassana, into the mind, he says that's where we apply, strictly speaking, vipassana, samatha vipassana, stopping or stillness. Jir, literally in Chinese, means to stop or to be still or even to dwell in something, and contemplating. And again, he presents these as this kind of interwoven, two-sided pair, sort of a yin-yang pair, okay? So this is the practically passage we have here. I'm going to do it line by line and then try to just make some observations, poke around in line by line, and I would welcome, when we have, I assume, some discussion time, maybe we can probe them together. So this is the stillness awareness of the mind for this practice. Sit upright and mindful, eliminating any disturbing sensations, abandoning any unruly ideations. Without thinking about anything else, but also without grabbing hold of any particular forms and appearances, just fix your mind exclusively on the total field of all phenomena. Letting each moment of experience be entirely identical to the total field of all phenomena. Fixing the mind on it is the stillness, the samatha. Letting each moment of experience be entirely identical to it is the awareness, the vipassana. Okay. Now, a couple things about this passage. We have to talk about this phrase, the total field of phenomena, first of all. It's in Chinese, fa tie, dharma realm, dharma dhatu is the Sanskrit term, which means the entire field of awareness of all phenomenal things. I try this translation is just me kind of groping for something here. Total field of all phenomena, because dhatu does mean field or space, and jie, the Chinese equivalent, also means a space. The space of all fa, of all dharmas, that means the entire space of all conceived and perceived entities of any kind, all contents of the mind. The term is also used roughly just to mean the entire expanse of the universe, okay? The entire totality of all that exists. So when Jiri says here, fix the mind on the totality of all that exists. rather a tall order, right? And he's using traditional meditation terminology. This term, fix the mind on, qi yuan, is the term that's usually moved. For example, if I were to meditate on my breath, fix the mind on the breath. Or if I were to fix my mind on one item in my total field of awareness, like a disc or something else that I was meditating on. It's the same term. And, of course, the technical meaning of samatha. All the weird stuff that's going to happen, you might say here, has to do with taking this thing which is intrinsic to the structure of awareness, which is taking a foreground out of a background, in other words, focusing on something, and then reapplying that to the totality, some weird totality effects. So Jiri is essentially trying to have these two things converge on the same object. The contemplation and, in other words, the vipassana and the samatha both have the same object. What does he mean phenomenologically by fix the mind on the totality of all awareness? Well, it seems to have something to do with what he's going to describe in the next paragraph, but an even distribution of awareness that includes everything without exception that can come into the mind, on the one hand, and on the other hand, space itself. You'll find meditations like this in early Chan materials, in Northern school Chan materials from Dunhuang, for example, viewing afar in an attempt to sort of embrace the entire totality of space even-handedly and let sort of things arise and fall within that space. You may be familiar with it. That motif in the Platform Sutra, where Huineng compares the mind to space filled with sun and moon and stars and so on. Empty space is a very common motif. Something like that is going on here. And the next phrase, fixing the mind on it, and then yinian fa jie. This is very interesting because there's no verb in that sentence. It just says one mind dharma dhatu, or one moment of thought, one thought dharma dhatu. Okay? Generally, these types of Chinese texts, whenever parallelism like that, we take that as a full identity. So making the mind identical to it, becoming aware of it whole-mindedly, but also that the one mind just becomes that entire dharma dhatu. So aware of everything that's happening in it, and as we're going to see, non-separated from it as the sole practice. Now, remember, this is done in a ritual setting, and it involves facing a Buddha or visualizing a Buddha and chanting the name of a Buddha. And so that is an expedient that, as you'll see in a moment, is very key to filling out the picture of what this actually means phenomenologically in terms of a practice. But that's the goal. And you can see that he's trying to take, whereas we, in traditional practice, you know, we focus on a particular object, and then that stilled state of mind is applied to things that arise and fall. That's the samatha vipassana. Now they are to converge on a single object, but that object is a weird object, which is the totality of all existence. Okay? I could say more about the lead up to that, about thoughts and clinging to appearances, but one quick note about that. One thing that seems to be involved here, he says, without thinking about anything else, literally says, without mixing in any thoughts. Okay? And I said, but also without grabbing hold of any particular forms of appearance. Now, I've added that but, taking there to be an implicit contrast between these two things. On the one hand, not thinking. On the other hand, not stopping at any particular form. In other words, what does the form of the totality look like? The word used here is to grasp it, but to attach to it. It's the same term used in technical Buddhist vocabulary in Chinese. But it also means to take determinately, as one thing or another, what that is. So we have an idea here of trying to embrace the totality, but without coming to rest on a final conclusion about how or what that is. And we have, I think, an explanation of precisely that point in the next paragraph, so let me go on here. Trust that all phenomena, without exception, are aspects of Buddhahood. I have to pause there. Okay? It says, 心一切法皆是佛法. Literally, believe, have faith, it's the word for faith, okay? Trust that all phenomena, and so this is bringing back the totality of all phenomena, are Buddha dharmas. All dharmas are Buddha dharmas. What does that mean? That seems to be the first clue he's given us about what the content of that fixing the mind on the totality and becoming identical to the totality would be. If I were to say, or someone were to say, all things are good, or if I say all things are pure, or if someone were to say all things are God, that would have a particular meaning in each case, right? And we have to think hard about the particular meaning of what it means to say all dharmas are Buddha dharmas. Doesn't mean all things were planned by the divine mind, right? As created by God or something like that. It doesn't mean they have a determinate character of being pure. In fact, I think what Dri means by this, well, we know what Buddha means. Buddha means awakening. So often this trope is used to say all dharmas are the dharmas of awakening, which can mean both are parts of the awareness of a Buddha, of enlightened awareness, cognition, experience, let's say, or express enlightened cognition. And we know that enlightened cognition, or this goes into Tiantai theory and Mahayana theory generally, has something to do with things being empty. Now, when we say they're empty, this is, pertains to the title of the book that Dan just held up. In Tiantai, there's I would argue, and you'll see this in this paragraph, a very specific meaning, or it's really a meaning they take from Nagarjuna, Madhyamaka, General Prajnaparamita literature, emptiness thought in Buddhism. And that is, we know that emptiness is meant to be a middle way. And it's a middle way between being and non-being. It's not the denial of being, it's not the affirmation of being. So it is not the wiping away of everything so that everything is a blank. And it's not the affirmation of things as being a particular way. What then can it be? What does it mean to say neither being nor non-being? I think we have a word in English for that, and that word is ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And the word ambiguity we normally think of as something that pertains only to subjectivity. That is, things in the world are just one way or the other. If they're ambiguous, it's because we're not seeing all of them, or we're not sure yet, or but in themselves, or in the mind of God, or if eventually when we figure everything out, they will be this or that. They will be being, or they will exist or not exist. It'll be true or false, right? It'll be red or green or large or small in some way or other. One way to think about emptiness, particularly in the Tiantai context, is as sort of ontological ambiguity, ambiguity that pertains to things themselves, that they actually are neither one way nor another. And phenomenologically, we understand that a little better than just a bunch of string of negations with a word like ambiguity. We understand what it means for something to be readable in more than one way. Mm-hmm. So the claim here is that things in and of themselves are always readable in more than one way, and their being read is part of what they are. So being read and readable by more than one thing is what things are. This pertains to the Tiantai notion we call Ichinen Sanzen, Inyen Sanchen, 3,000 realms present in any particular moment of thought or moment of experience. So we begin. So to say that all things are aspects of Buddhahood is to say that all things are neither this nor that, but readable as this and that, and equally justifiably described as this, that, neither, or both, if you like to put it that way. That's what it is to be a Buddha. That's what a Buddha sees. And when Judy says here, all dharmas, all phenomena are aspects of Buddhahood, I believe this is what he means. They are all neither permanent nor impermanent, both permanent and impermanent, fully impermanent. This is a Tiantai formula. Self, non-self, both, neither, etc. Okay? All aspects. So all expressions of all also means by which to realize Buddhahood. So expressions of upayas or skillful means that flow from Buddhahood as well. This next paragraph is sort of the meat of the thing, and it's very dense. I'm going to go line by line. He says, as such, none can be prior to or subsequent to any of the others, as there are no longer any genuine boundaries between them. This is really the payoff line of the content of what it means for all dharmas to be Buddha dharmas. No boundaries between them. Now, this discussion of boundaries, and the term is, it really sticks out in the Chinese. It's panzi. Literally, no boundaries. Tiantai meditation in the fourth type that I mentioned, where we observe the rising and ceasing of thoughts, uses a logical procedure that comes out of Nagarjuna. I don't know if you guys discuss him, the great theorist of emptiness in Madhyamaka thought, which does a kind of reductio ad absurdum, a reduction to absurdity of the very idea of there being finite entities. And things have to be finite to be determinate. Okay? They have to be separable from what they are not. They have to exclude what they are not, to be white rather than black. If the boundary between this and that cannot be established, then this and that cannot be established. If you want, you can say, think this way. A country that has no boundaries has no territory. They are strictly correlative to each other, okay? So much of the way the discursive meditation in Tiantai works is an inquiry into boundaries. First of all, boundaries between subject and object. Where is it? Does it belong to the subject side or the object side? Or is it an overlap of the two, or does it belong to neither? All four of those are seen to be incoherent. This is an actual meditation procedure, rather logical one, okay, where you actually raise that question. Boundary between this white and the non-white of this cup, or cupness and non-cupness conceptually. Or, probably the one most often used, between this moment and a previous moment. This moment and a future moment. Because for me to experience this moment, qua experience, means for me to experience a difference between this moment and a previous moment. If I were hearing a continuous tone, I would never hear it, right? Just like fish don't know what water is, as they say, right? So if I'm experiencing something, it has to be contrasted with something which it excludes. But that means it had to arise from a previous situation in which it did not pertain, which it did not exist. this meditation on the arising of thought then looks at that boundary, the boundary between not yet arising, this experience, like that feeling, right, and the moment of its arising. I inquire into that interface, that boundary, and they're always shown to be incoherent, okay? But when they're incoherent, again, that doesn't leave a big blank. I sometimes say, again, emptiness does not mean, in Tiantai they won't even stop at emptiness, they'll say the mean. The mean, emptiness, and provisional positing all equal. And what that means is when we think of ambiguity or we think of non-boundary, we are not to think of sort of a black void, or we're not supposed to think of a white wall. It's a white wall has no form on it. No, a white wall has a form. A white wall is definite. A white wall excludes something. It excludes the color black, the color red, the color green, right? The kind of not being there definitively we're talking about here, and this is another favored Chan or Zen trope, is the mirror, right? A mirror is more blank than a white wall. A mirror is more blank than empty space, because a mirror neither includes nor excludes any color. To exist definitively means to exclude what it is not. Okay? And that means to have definite boundaries. So when Juri asserts here these things have no front and back boundaries, first thing he's applying to is in time. Okay? This is about against being here now kind of question. Okay? The division between moments, between the experience of pleasure and the experience of pain, between your delusion and your future Buddhahood, right? Between your childhood and now, or yesterday and today, or this and this, right? That boundary is not a definitive boundary. But it is not, in the Tiantai picture, that doesn't mean the two things aren't there. It means both of them are on both sides. Mm-hmm. They're both found everywhere. I sometimes use this floating hot dog thing to try to explain. We'll do that one in the Q&A. But in any case, no boundary between them, and there are a lot of consequences to there not being a boundary. First of all, temporal boundaries, and second of all these other kinds of boundaries, subject-object boundaries, okay? Between one determinacy and another. So he goes on, thus there can be no separate knower and describer of them. Well, that one's particularly about the boundary between the knower and the known. Okay. But if there are no separations, if I cannot separate, if I cannot determine which is the knower and which is the known, as he says in the next line, nothing can be definitively described or known about them. So there's the emptiness point, okay? They are beyond thought, beyond conception. But again, as you see in the next line, that doesn't mean a blank. He says, hence they cannot definitively exist or not exist, cannot be a knower or a non-knower, cannot, for that matter, be known or unknown. Okay? It's a kind of a negation of the negation. That's like to say they are unknown or to say there is no known, that would be like the blank wall. It excludes something. That means it's definite. That means it has definite, coherent boundaries, conceptually, temporally, spatially, some other way, phenomenologically. Very key, typical Tiantai move here, the negation of the negation. So I'm borrowing a kind of Hegelian term for that. But it's important. You just think of the blank wall versus the mirror, okay? So precisely because there's no boundaries, nothing can be known. But if nothing can be known, that doesn't mean the exclusion or the definitive unknowability, as if that were excluding all knowledge or experience or information. It's an allowing of both sides at once. What picture do we end up with then? What's the contemplation? It goes on. Free of the duality of these extremes, they dwell only in their not dwelling exclusively in anything or anywhere. Buzhu. This, of course, again, a Platform Sutra term. Also, it's in the Diamond Sutra, the non-dwelling of mind. That means, again, this sort of... remember that it's quiescence and contemplation, and these are thought of in a kind of yin-yang way, where one is stillness and one is action. He's trying to depict something that is not pure quiescence, but is quiescent even as inactivity. That's what he's getting you here. So the picture of emptiness here, of non-duality here, is also non-dwelling. Non-dwelling means it never rests in any one determinate thing, even blankness. That means it's infinitely productive of manifestations. Mm. Okay, it's overflowing. It can't be contained in any conceptualization, nor, for that matter, in the removal of all conceptualization. It can't be contained in that either. So go wherever you want, you're always going to have more. And the phrase I use in that book is more tuitivity. There's always more to whatever you are seeing, and that's not added to it. That's what it is. It is itself and more. There's a kind of unseen back to each thing, and you never see all of it. So it's always spilling more of itself. There's always more phenomena in any phenomena. This gets back to Indra's net kind of stuff you may have talked about in here. Through this particular line of thinking. So they dwell only in their not dwelling. That's supposed to be both sides. Dwell, that's the quiescence. Not dwelling is this constant productivity of manifestation. Just as the Buddhists dwell in their secure and peaceful nirvana, the quiescent extinguishment, that's the traditional definition of nirvana, which is itself also the total field of all phenomena. Now here, Jiri starts to do this thing that he's going to do a number of times through his text, which is he identifies each particular thing with the whole. Identifies just nirvana, which was supposed to be the negation of the whole field of phenomena, right, in early Buddhism, as itself the field of all phenomena. If you look for, I don't know how we're doing for time here.
Well, you know, maybe 5 or 10 more minutes before.
All right, then I'm going to skip. I'm going to skip because if you look at it, this is easy to trace in here. If you look for this capitalized phrase, total field of all phenomena, look at the different things that Jiri identifies this with. He says, nirvana is itself the total field of all phenomena. If you skip down, he says, each and every phenomenon is itself none other than the total field of all phenomena. This is another implication of non-boundary, non-separation. This is really important, so I'm going to spend 1 minute on this point. When we think of non-separation in ordinary speech, this is another easy error to make, I think, in reading this kind of text. One is the one I just mentioned, when you think of negation as implying a blank, because a blank is an affirmation, okay? But another kind of error is when you think non-separation means that this is one part, this is another part. They're stuck together somehow, you can't detach them, but this part, that part is that part. That won't fly, okay? That won't fly because what you're doing there is uploading, you might say, the separation to a more self-contained category, just the appearances or just the part. You're saying, well, the substance can't be separated, but the parts can be separated because space divides out into discrete chunks. That's exactly what's being denied. It doesn't matter which level you go to, because any kind of boundary, conceptual, spatial, phenomenological, is subject to this same critique. Okay, and I didn't go into the Nagarjuna details of the critique, but we could do that too. So if you want to think about inseparability just as a mental picture, don't think about two things that are stuck together so that, okay, I'm sitting in, like, you know, because we all know that, right? You could say, you know, poverty and wealth are inseparable in any society, right? Or in a particular type of society. But I can still be sitting here in wealth perfectly fine, never touching that poverty side of it, right? That's not the picture here. You got to think of sort of contiguity at each and every point within each and every part. Mm-hmm. This is where we get this sort of picture of the 3,000 in every moment of experience. Okay? That's because you try to separate even at the level of part. Say, well, they're all one whole, but this part is this part and this part is the other part. That, the same critique will apply. So this is why he claims each and every phenomenon is the totality. That means anything you experience or see is the totality of all possible experiences manifesting as that particular thing, but always in its periphery or contained within it are all other contrary things as well, the more intuitivity. The other image I often like to use, you know those photo mosaics, right, where they have a bunch of little pictures, you look at it from a distance and it's like a face of Abraham Lincoln or something, right? And then you look closely, oh, there's a little picture of, you know, a Civil War scene or blah, 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 blah. It's like that, right? You're not looking at anything different. You're just looking at it differently and you're seeing all these other phenomena, all these other characteristics. This is the picture here. So he goes on to say, another thing I want to say about that. When you make this totalizing move, there's a logical step. I said that things are determinate because they have boundaries, right? So that which has no boundaries cannot be determinate. That means determination, to say something is white or black or red or brown, always implies contrast. Contrast to what it is not, the exclusion of what it is not. So I cannot really say the entire universe is blue, right? Because if the entire universe is blue, then there's nothing outside of that blue against which it can be. There's no background against which the blueness could be perceived. Nothing stands apart from blue. If I say it's blue everywhere, it's blue nowhere. If I say it's red everywhere, it's red nowhere. So I could equally say it's all red or it's all blue, and they mean the same thing. Okay? Which is that it's neither blue nor non-blue, neither red nor non-blue. Blue and red interpenetrate. I use the term intersubsume sometimes for the mean in Tiantai. So when he says everything is the whole, and the whole is nonetheless all these alternate things at once, all these mutually exclusive things at once. Okay? So nirvana is the whole. He says each and every phenomenon is the whole. Again, it doesn't come into sort of an undifferentiated blank whole that's the one single whole. No, there's an infinite number of the whole. Okay? Every individual thing is the whole, yet again, in a different guise, in a different upayic condition. So notice that he says, what else does he identify with it? Look at I think my page numbers are a little different from me. The paragraph that begins, it is very remarkable indeed.
Page two.
Yeah. At the top, maybe?
The
middle, yes, the middle of the page, right? He says, having no definite form or attribute, and thus no hearing and seeing and knowing, the total field of all phenomena admits of no realization even by a Buddha. And he does a funny thing here. He doesn't just simply do this by saying, well, we already said it can't be this, it can't be that, it can't be an instrument thing. Rather, he says, what is the reason? It is that a Buddha is himself precisely the total field of all phenomena. To say that the total field of all phenomena has a realization of the total field of all phenomena would be contentious and meaningless talk. Okay? Because the Buddha is the universe, he cannot realize the universe. Because he is the truth, he cannot realize the truth. Knowing implies a separation relationship where one can stand apart from the thing known. So there can be no realization precisely because each thing is the whole. Okay? But note, interestingly, a new version, I guess, the last paragraph, lust and rage. Or let's go to the one before that. Since we can find no things that are mundane and deluded, what is there to abandon? Okay. Since we can find no things that are sagely impure, what is there to achieve? The same goes for samsara, nirvana, defilement, and purity. Not abandoning, not obtaining, dwelling only in the ultimate reality, in this way see each sentient being as the true Buddha, who is the total field of all phenomena. Okay, each sentient being. Why is the sentient being the Buddha? Because each of them is the whole, which cannot be definitely Buddha or sentient being, enlightened or deluded. And Jiri pushes this now in a very typical direction. So, to finish up, two more bits. See lust and rage and delusion and all other afflictive passions, that's kleshas, and disturbances as actions that are always already quiescent. Neither false views nor the unconditioned, this is another middle way thing, practice the Buddha's path, blah, blah, blah. It is called truly dwelling in each of the afflictive passions and disturbances, seeing each of them to be the total field of all. So every affliction, too, to be seen to be the totality, not separable from Buddhahood, not separable from one's own attempt to move away from it, let's say, but it's something which subsumes, is findable, is readable in every other phenomena, and therefore is already absolute, quiescent, unchanging, simultaneously an affliction and an aspect of Buddhahood. All dharmas are Buddha dharmas, he says. This goes even farther in the next one. Remember he said the Buddha can't realize the Dharma Dhatu because he is the Dharma Dhatu. Well, then he says, karma, the five grave sins, killing father and mother, arhat, shedding the blood of a Buddha, are precisely wisdom itself, for there is no definite mark of duality differentiating wisdom on the one hand and these five sins on the other. There is no separate entity that feels them, knows them, discerns them. You skip down, all karma and conditionings dwell in the ultimate reality. One more line. This is the contemplation of karma itself as precisely the authoritative signature of the total field of all phenomena. That's the Fajia Yin. It really means the same thing as the total field of all phenomena. I have a little footnote on that, because this is a term used for like a magic spell, okay? To dispel demons. So the next line he says, all karma is unconquerable by all the demons, just like the authoritative signature of the total field of all phenomena. The demon, he says, is such that the four types of demons can never destroy it or abuse it. And why? Because the demons are themselves the authoritative signature of the total field of all phenomena. How could the authoritative signature of the total field of all phenomena destroy the authoritative signature of the total field of all phenomena? This is, sometimes the phrase is, a sword cannot cut itself. And you know, in Chan, they often use an eye cannot see itself. Well, this sort of relation of the whole to the whole, if you like, cuts both ways, right? In other words, for the same reason that a Buddha cannot realize the universe because he is it, the demons and the evils cannot disturb it because they are it. Okay? They cannot impinge upon it. That also requires a fixed boundary of one thing impinging upon another. Okay? So what we have here is a spelling out of, it's a sort of a handful of motifs that are gathered together in this idea of taking the entire Dharma Dhatu, field of all phenomena, as the object of concentration, or all space, and becoming identical, non-separate from that totality of all phenomena. And simply, I don't know if you consider it a very simple idea or a very weird, complicated idea. It's kind of both, right? It really all rests on pushing that idea about boundaries, of separation, all the way to the bottom, about sort of the negation of both extremes, non-duality, if you like, in this particular way, and making of that the centerpiece of this practice. So I guess I'll stop for Q&A, but I'm very curious about how this relates to, I mean, historically, it very much does relate to all Zen practice, I would say, in one way or another, sort of directly or indirectly. That is, this is what meditation meant in China in the formative period of the Chan movement. Okay, so in the 7th century, 8th century, 9th century, and then on and on. Of course, historically things transformed very radically in lots of different ways. But this is the background, and these are the resources. This is the actual description of what Buddhist practice is. That, first of all, existed in China as sort of the fullest expression of Sinicized East Asian Buddhism. And in Dogen's case, as Dan mentioned, Dogen was a Tendai monk. Dogen was reading this before he went to China, right? This is what informs the ritual practices on Mount Hiei, for example, where I think they even tried to do this 90-day thing. So maybe we can start the discussion. Those grounds are the main point you guys would like to talk about.
Well, just to open the discussion, I have some questions, but I'll leave those. Basically, what you're describing is one way of talking about our practice. Mm. We talk about just sitting as objectless meditation. Provisionally, we may focus on breath or counting breaths or sounds or mantras, but basically just Dogen's practice and our practice is just to sit. No particular object or objective. And that is another way of talking. What you're talking about is a kind of context of that, of boundarylessness.
That's right.
Yeah, it's very connected. And Hongzhen and Dogen talk about meditation on space. So anyway, very much contiguous with our practice. And I'll just open it up to questions and responses. Yes, sir.
Well, you finished with Dogen. Leaves the Tendai Monastery and goes to China. And the story is that, I know this isn't exactly original Enlightenment thought, we can see the connection, but originally the story is like, if we're originally enlightened, why do we go?
Yeah.
This idea of more intuitiveness we talk about,
yeah.
I mean, sort of one implication of that is that anything, nothing equals itself in some sense. Like, if I look at Brooks of Porin, and I have this sort of experience, ideas, all that, no matter how far I inquire, there's that backside of the cup, and everything is like that. And if I look deeply enough, I find all these people there as well as the floor and all that stuff, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
So if nothing, and you know, kind of flipping that around, I don't know if this is even necessary, you know, but it's just the other way of looking at nothing. In some sense, A is never A, or never exclusively A. You know, so you could almost equally say less intuitiveness, right? I can look at each phenomenal thing and I can say this bell contains the entire universe. You know, Lake doses, you know. But
yeah,
you know, there's also the sort of realm where, and I don't know if this is suchness or whatever, where, you know, the bell is just the bell, right? This is just this.
Yeah.
And that seems like the ground where we're motivated to practice. So I can see this whole idea coming out of I can see this whole kind of way of visualizing the world as being a result of practice. And maybe this is just the old historical question about Tendai and all this, but it's like, I don't see how it would motivate practice.
That's a great question. Can I?
Yes, please.
You done with that? Okay. A couple of things in there. So, of course, you're quite right. Let me start by saying, right, one thing that's important to realize about this, as I said, this is a specific meditation practice. It's a very formal practice. So when Judy says, trust that all dharmas are Buddha dharmas, he's not saying all dharmas are Buddha dharmas. He's saying for the purpose of this meditation, this is how one is to dispose of one's mind. Mm. So actually, what it's almost a thought experiment. It's almost a visualization. You can see him going through the steps here, even when he talks about visualizing a Buddha image. Okay, so even the image. And this pertains very closely to the kind of larger epistemological question, because the motivation for practice actually comes way before this in the text, right? That has to do with very standard Buddhist stuff, very old style Buddhism, suffering, the bodhisattva vow, impermanence, that kind of thing, okay? And one thing, you know, you have this sort of juggling act where Juri is kind of suggesting like 50 different types of practice. This particular one is the one that goes sort of original enlightenment-y, right? Because it starts with, okay, set yourself up like this, go for the totality right from the beginning, just keep trying to fix yourself at the beginning. You're going to keep falling off, so then chant Buddha names and all this other stuff, right? The Buddhas will appear later on. He says, Buddhas appear, that's like when you have a dream about a sex dream about a woman. She doesn't really come, you don't really go, but you have this experience. Same when the Buddhas come. He actually says this. So he's not claiming about any of these meditative things that they're true or real. He's claiming these are one strategy among a large variety. So this one is about see everything as Buddhahood right from the start. And you're going to see how you're going to fail at that, and then you're going to have to chant Buddha names and all this stuff. The last one is about watching your deluded thoughts arise. Mm. So that one is, you don't try to fix it on any particular object at all. You just, in fact, he has a long, very famous passage on the meditation on evil thoughts. And there's this great comparison. He says, you know, it's like fishing, you know. When you get the hook in that fish, you don't want to pull it off too quickly, because then you'll break the line, it's too strong for you. So he's following that evil thought. Just keep that evil thought, because that means deluded thoughts, that means this is a cup, things like that, or I want this, or I don't want this, or, you know, three poisons, all that stuff. And this is where you look at the beginning, you know, the arising of that thought and things like that. You don't interfere, you don't try to say, hey, wait, no, it's all original enlightenment. No, you don't do that. You do strictly do a deconstruction of the arising of those thoughts themselves. So he's got a whole bunch of things going on at once. Epistemologically, this is what the so-called three truths is all about. So in Tiantai, what the lecture says, there's three, not two truths. This is one weird thing about Tiantai. I think when you read things like Genjo Koan and things like that, Dogen texts, interesting to bring this threefold matrix into the background a little bit. So, you know, most Mahayana Buddhism has two truths, right? Conventional truth, ultimate truth. Conventional truth is like a raft, right? It's a way, it's a means by which you get to ultimate truth. That means it has to transcend itself, right? It's provisional, it's temporary, but it needs to be followed for a while. You can't get to ultimate truth without conventional truth. So, right, in my practice, I gotta think this is a cup, I'm suffering, I'm me, you're you, blah, 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 right? And then I get beyond that, and the reason those are good truths is because they allow me to get beyond that, right? That is what the Buddha says originally. Why do I say this rather than that? Because this is conducive to leading sentient beings to awakening. Well, in Tendai, there are three truths: conventional truth, ultimate truth, and the mean, the middle. Okay? And this changes the picture in a lot of interesting, really kind of radical ways, because it means the raft is never really discarded. It's almost as if you were to say, you take a raft not to the other shore where you discard the raft, you take that raft, and where you end up is like a raft factory. It produces millions more rafts, or it turns out the raft was a bridge that led to a million other bridges, something like that.
Dogen says when you get to the other shore, don't drop the raft, keep hold on to the raft as you climb the mountain.
There you go, exactly. Because this is actually a Lotus Sutra thing, right? If you think about the Lotus Sutra, the lost sun story, you know, I maybe have time to get into this, but you know, the upayas are exactly the inheritance. Put it that way. They're not what, they're what used to draw him in, and they're what he gets at the end. Okay, so it changes that raft paradigm very radically. Well, what that means is, three truths also means when we observe something, they want to say conventional truth. Well, first of all, there's an infinite number of conventional truths for Tien, right? Not just the one, two, three, or something, right? That comes from another, it's a whole other discussion. But for our purposes, we can just say, they want to say it is a cup, it is not a cup, and then the mean. Those are the three truths, okay? So I'm suffering, suffering is empty, and then the mean, the middle, which is neither the one nor the other, is both and so on, and which equalizes that originally hierarchical relationship between the two truths, so that it becomes not a raft relationship, but a mutual intersubsumption relationship that goes from one to the other. So they would want to say, yes, you never get rid of conventional truth. You never throw away the raft, okay? It's just that they ramify. In a way, you get more conventional truths, you get more mastery of conventional truths, maybe alternate conventional truths, but you're never...
Demons continue to disturb the universe.
What's that?
Demons continue to disturb the universe.
Okay, yeah, that's right. That's right, that too. That too. Although every single thing that's negated here, right, is also an upaya. So they want to say, whatever you're... There is no... This is why in Tien they talk about the mutual interpervasion of the 10 realms, right? Buddhahood, Bodhisattva, Shravaka, Pratika Buddha, then devas, gods, humans, animals, asuras, hungry ghosts, and demons. Okay? And what that means is, there is no Buddha who's just a Buddha and not also those 9 other things. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Never separate from those 9. That's why it says all dharmas are Buddha dharmas. That means, doesn't mean they cease being the specific things they are. They mean just as they are Buddha dharmas. Now that can be read in, that can flip-flop, right? As you say, that can be original enlightenment, depending on what it means to say it's everything is Buddha dharma. Does that mean you don't have to do anything about it? Well, then you can, in Dogen's case, I would look at the last little parable in Genjo Koan, right, about the fan, right? It's there. And you don't understand what it means for it to reach everywhere, right? I mean, Dogen doesn't deny original enlightenment. He gives a gloss on it, and in my view, a very orthodox gloss on it, very orthodox Tensai gloss on it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would say, I guess.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So let's have at least a couple more questions, but it's really obvious, Brooke, you have to come back.
Okay.
And you don't live that far away, so good, that's going to happen. But let's continue a little bit. It's we're already at time, but that's okay. Who else would like to offer a question or comment or response? Please. Jen.
Very small. It kind of bothers me that aid is not equal aid. Because it's like the original... I can't think what you call this. You know, nobody ever defines a point. Uh-huh. Nobody ever defines a line.
Yeah.
It's called an axiom. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And A equals A.
Is an axiom, yeah.
In math.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I don't think this actually pertains to the previous question in an interesting way, right? Because we don't actually have to say in this... Buddhist system, at least, we don't have to say that A does not equal A, as if that were definitively true. What they will say is that, like all those axioms, like points or lines being made of points and things like that, those are conventional truths. That means they're limited, they work within a certain sphere.
And if it's a certain thing that you're talking about,
that's right.
A equals A.
That's right. And once you're in that system and those presuppositions, that's going to hold as long as it holds. It can't be a definitive denial that it's absolutely always true that A does not equal A. No. Within certain possibly very broad parameters, right? Very large parameters, yes, A equals A, just like the cup is a cup. But the intent that they would like to say, whenever we're looking at some, I call it locally coherent, okay? That's how I translate provisional conventional truth. That is to say, anything that's coherent is locally coherent. And anything that's locally coherent is ipso facto globally incoherent.
but it also happens that you can get into mathematical systems where A does not equal.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And you might even want to say they imply each other, right? If you really think through the A equals A system, you're going to come to its limits. Right? And when you come to its limits, you have to say that there, that I'm positive in knowing what it is means I'm able to stand outside of it. Yes.
So, I'm not saying that it's an approach, but certainly Kintan would have the same sort of, would agree with Dogen, it sounds like the same. It's not that all things have Buddha nature, but all things are Buddha nature.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. In fact, that phrase comes up in a Tang text, not glossing the very line that Dogen does in those three fascicles, three, right, in the Shamadenso, it's the long thing on Buddha nature. And he does a very creative, philologically very creative thing with it, but just with the actual Chinese characters. But the very point that, no, we do not have Buddha nature, we are Buddha nature, that is stated in a text called The Diamond Scalpel, written by Zhangran, the sort of second great Tiantai master, which is really a text about the Buddha nature of insentient beings. Which becomes a point of contention after that discussion segues into that. So yeah, absolutely. That's a very key, that's a very good issue by which to sort of distinguish between, you know, a lot of phrases that sound very similar, right? All things, Buddha nature, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that when you can sort of slice that if you want to say, well, what do you mean have Buddha nature? The whole argument that Zhangran in that text is to say this conception as if Buddha nature is possessed inside only certain beings, right? So that it's like within your body or something like that, or it's identified with your mind or something like along those lines, or is it potential to do some other thing or something like that? All those things lead immediately to contradictions. He argues in a rather different way than Dogen does, but yes, definitely they would agree on that point. And I think that's when Dogen is critically looking at certain things in Song Zen in China, right? And he's often very scathing. Right, he will say, "Oh, these rice bags in China now are saying that, you know, the mind is eternal, but the body dies." This kind of crazy nonsense, and you know, like, or that's, you know, like, the mind is already enlightened, and all you need to do is you don't have to practice; you just need to know that the fire god brings fire and all this sort of thing. I think he's has, to begin with, a different orientation toward all that stuff and is polemically addressing things that had happened in Chinese Buddhism that had moved away from that. My view in sort of, we were talking about at dinner, people like Zongmi and Shuang, certain things that happened in Tang Buddhism. So I think he's mining the resources of his Tendai tradition, maybe consciously, maybe unconsciously, and just instinctively reacts against that. I think he was sensitized to these sort of subtle dualisms because it was a large part of Tiantai dialectic was to sort of ferret them out. So, I would say it's still part of that discussion.
Other questions or comments? One more. Just...
David. One comment, if I may play, just for an old National Geographic that talks about matter and dark matter and dark energy, and that most of the universe, only 5% of it is matter that we really know.
Yeah.
26% is energy that we really know.
Right.
And the other 70% is what we don't know.
Exactly. And so that means even the part we know, we don't know.
For sure.
Well, okay, this has been great, and we're just starting, so yes, you have to come back. We will close formally with the four Bodhisattva vows. Please join if you have.
Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it.
So thank you all very much. Thank you, Brooke. And I just wanted to say the question that I had at the very end of your talk, which you answered, is that all of this is based on this Bodhisattva vow and ethics, you know, and this piece of it doesn't point to the ethics directly, but it's that's the underground basis of it. So